वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो
नमो
भगवते
भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ॐ नमो भगवते
ॐ
वासुदेवाय।
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरये श्रीनृतं स्वकृता कृष्णपुण्यश्रावणकीर्तनः विजयन्तस्तो हि भद्राणि विदुनोति सुहृत्सुतां नस्तप्रियेष्व भद्रेषु नित्यं भगवत सेवया भगवत्युत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्टिकी। So we're reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam. It's Canto 1, Chapter 7, entitled The Son of Drona Punished. And we're going through verses 28 through 32, because it's kind of small purpose, it's mostly descriptive. So we'll start with 28. We'll chant the verse together, read the word for word translation purport, then the other ones I'll just quickly read the Sanskrit and the translations and the purports, and then we'll carry on from there. So starting with 28, Nahyasyanyatamam
kinchit
astram
pratyavakarshanam
jahyastratejunadham
यस्त्रतेज उन्मदम्
अस्त्रज्ञो यस्त्रतेजसा
यस्त्रतेजसा
नह्यस्यान्यतमं किञ्चित्
नह्यस्यान्यतमं
अस्त्रं प्रत्यवकर्षणम्
अस्त्रं प्रत्यवकर्षणम्
जह्यस्त्रतेजोनधम्
जहस्त्रस्तवोदनम्
अस्त्रज्ञो ह्यस्त्रतेजसा
अस्त्रज्ञो
ह्यस्त्रतेजसा
न ह्यस्यान्यतमं किञ्चित्
न ह्यस्यान्यतमं
किञ्चित्
अस्त्रं प्रत्यवकर्षणम्
अस्त्रस्य प्रकर्षणम्
जह्यस्त्रतेजोनधम्
जहस्त्रतेजोनधम्
अस्त्रज्ञो ह्यस्त्रतेजसो
अस्त्रयो ह्यस्त्रतेजसो
न ह्यस्यान्यतमं किञ्चित्
न ह्यस्यास्त्रकिञ्चित्
अस्त्रं प्रत्यवकर्षणम्
अस्त्रप्रत्ययवकर्षणम्
च ह्यस्त्रतेज उन्मथम्
य ह्यस्त्रतेज उदनम्
अस्त्रज्ञो ह्यस्त्रतेजसा
अस्त्रयो ह्यस्त्रतेजसा।
Anyone else?
Nahi sayasana kinchit astra praja karnasanam
jahasya teja unadam
jahasya teja unadam
astra jahasya teja
अस्त्रगेवस्यस्तेजसा नाह्यस्यानन्तमङ्किञ्चिद्
अस्तंसायेवकर्षणम् अस्त्रतेजानुदम् अस्त्रतेजोन्मदम्
अस्त्रोग्यो
Yastra Tejasa.
Yastra Yogyastra Tejasa. Yastra
Yastra Yastra Yastra
Yastra Yastra Yastra Yastra
Yastra Yastra Yastra
Get it wrong, Prabhu. Chanted it so beautifully, nobody wanted to chant it. Maybe kind of screw it up after he did it so nicely.
Hello, anybody can hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm trying to figure out how to mute, sorry.
Okay. Certainly.
Certainly.
Asya. Of it.
Of it.
Anyatamam. Other.
Other.
Kinchit.
Anything.
Astram.
Weapon. Prati.
Counter.
Avakarshanam.
Reactionary.
Jahi.
Subdue it.
Astratejaha.
The glare of this weapon. Unadham. Very powerful.
Astajna.
Expert in military science.
As a matter of fact.
Astratejasa.
By the influence of your weapon.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Translation is, O Arjun, only another Brahmastra can counteract this weapon. Since you are expert in the military science, subdue this weapon's glare with the power of your own weapon. Purport, for the atomic bombs, there is no counterweapon to neutralize the effects. But by subtle science, the action of a Brahmastra can be counteracted. And those who were expert in the military science in those days could counteract the Brahmastra. The son of Dronacharya did not know the art of counteracting the weapon. And therefore, Arjuna was asked to counteract it by the power of his own weapon.
Okay, Prabhus, since Giri Govardhan is going to speak for the next half hour, 45 minutes, why don't we all mute? I need everybody who's on Skype to go ahead and mute, hit the mute button. Everybody know what that is? Any of our new people? Okay, so please go ahead and mute. Thank you, Giri Govardhan Prabhu.
Okay, so we're going to go through text 32. So text 29 is Sutta Uvacha, Shudva Bhagavata Proktam Palguna Paraviraha. Shushvapastam parikramya brahmam brahmastram sundade. Shisuta Goswami said, hearing this from the personality of Godhead, Arjuna touched water for purification, and after circumambulating Lord Sri Krishna, he cast his brahmastra weapon to counteract the other one. Text 30. Samhatyanyanyamubayos tejasi sharasamvrite avritarodasi kancha Bhavradatarkavanivat. When the rays of the two Brahmastras combined, a great circle of fire, like the disk of the sun, covered all outer space and the whole firmament of planets. Purport, the heat created by the flash of a Brahmastra resembles the fire exhibited in the sun globe at the time of cosmic annihilation. The radiation of atomic energy is very insignificant in comparison to the heat produced by a Brahmastra. The atomic bomb explosion can at utmost blow up one globe, but the heat produced by the Brahmastra can destroy the whole cosmic situation. The comparison is therefore made to the heat at the time of the annihilation. And then text 31. Drishtvastrate jastutayo sri lokan pradahan mahat tadyamana praja sarva sambhatakammanam sita. All the population of the three worlds was scorched by the combined heat of the weapons. Everyone was reminded of the Samvartaka fire, which takes place at the time of annihilation. Purport, the three worlds are the upper, lower, and intermediate planets of the universe. Although the Brahmastra was released on this earth, the heat produced by the combination of both weapons covered all the universe, and all the populations on all the different planets began to feel the heat excessively and compared it to that of the Samvartaka fire. No planet, therefore, is without living beings, as less intelligent materialistic men think. And text 32, the final verse. Pajopadravam alaksha lokavyati karam chitam matam cha vasudevasya samjaharajuno dvayam. Thus seeing the disturbance of the general populace and the imminent destruction of the planets, Arjuna at once retracted both Brahmastra weapons as Lord Sri Krishna desired. Purport, the theory that the modern atomic bomb explosions can annihilate the world is childish imagination. First of all, the atomic energy is not powerful enough to destroy the world. And secondly, ultimately, it all rests on the supreme will of the Supreme Lord, because without his will or sanction, nothing can be built up or destroyed. It is foolish also to think that natural laws are ultimately powerful. Material nature's law works under the direction of the Lord, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. The Lord says there that natural laws work under his supervision. The world can be destroyed only by the will of the Lord and not by the whims of tiny politicians. Lord Sri Krishna desired that the weapons released by both Drauni and Arjuna be withdrawn, and it was carried out by Arjuna at once. Similarly, there are many agents of the all-powerful Lord, and by his will only can one execute what he desires. Om Agyanatimirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Dena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. So I guess let's quickly recap those verses. Okay. O Arjuna, only another Brahmastra can counteract this weapon. Since you are expert in the military science, subdue this weapon's glare with the power of your own weapon. Sri Suta Goswami said, hearing this from the personality of Godhead, Arjuna touched water for purification, the Achman, and after circumambulating Lord Sri Krishna, he cast his Brahmastra weapon to counteract the other one. When the rays of the two Brahmastras combined, a great circle of fire like the disk of the sun covered all outer space and the whole firmament of planets. All the population of the three worlds was scorched by the combined heat of the weapons. Everyone was reminded of the Samvartaka fire, which takes place at the time of annihilation. Thus, seeing the disturbance of the general populace and the imminent destruction of the planets, Arjuna at once retracted both Brahmastra weapons as Lord Sri Krishna desired. So, Ashwatthama, you know, having disgracefully killed the sons of Draupadi, in their sleep, and was fleeing, of course, Arjuna, who had promised Draupadi that she would take her bath, standing on the severed head of Ashwatthama. He went, Arjuna went in pursuit of him, and as it was became clear to Ashwatthama that he would be overtaken and captured, he desperately released his, you know, the most powerful weapon, trying to save his skin. And Prabhupada here says that he wasn't even expert in the use of the weapon. Usually one has to know how to use it and to retract it. And so he wasn't able to even retract it. So he was ready to, you know, blow up the whole universe practically simply to save his own hide, which is quite unkshatriya-like. And then Krishna gives the remedy to the situation, tells Arjuna that you know how to do both things. You can throw a Brahmastra and retract it. And so if you release your own Brahmastra, and then retracted, they both will be retracted, and the situation will be saved. And so Arjuna complies. He does ask, and then he circumambulates Krishna. And Prabhupada is mentioning in the purport that all the natural laws are actually controlled by Krishna, and nothing can be done without the sanction of Krishna. We think, and it says in Bhagavad Gita, right, that due to the presence of the false ego, we think that we become very foolish, like an ass, and think that we're actually doing things ourselves, when actually everything. Bhakti Santa Saraswati was kind of very emphasized this. He always said that instead of saying that yes, we can go ahead and do something, he would say this kind of yes, it may be done if Krishna is desires. He'd always emphasize how that Krishna's desire is always present in every activity. So Arjuna first, it says, he circumambulates Krishna, follows his order, and saves the population of not only the earth but also so many other planets from the destruction by this Brahmastra, this very powerful weapon. And so it's a little curious, right, to our modern ears, that because we see that Arjuna is there on his chariot, right, drawn by horses and a charioteer, and Prabhupada is emphasizing throughout these little purports the relative power of the Brahmastra versus the relative impotence of modern nuclear weapons. Right, we're quite, those of us who grew up, in through the Cold War and things like that, and through the nuclear age, right? We were always very afraid of a nuclear war. World War III would come, and all the arsenals they first there was the A bomb and then the hydrogen bomb, and because it never was really thought that the whole Earth would be destroyed, but just that the people would be, and the creatures would be, that they couldn't actually blow up the whole planet, but that enough radiation from enough explosions might eradicate most of life. And so this was seemingly to modern understanding, right? This was the highest development of weaponry and producing a great deal of terror. But here, so Prabhupada is saying, the nuclear weapons are really inconsequential in comparison to the power of the Brahmastras. So it's interesting the Vedic notion of technology. Right? It says that there's in the universe, we're living in the middle planetary systems. And so we're kind of subject to influences from above and below. And in the age of Kali, we're a bit more influenced by the lower planetary systems. And, there's Swargalok, heavenly planets where the devatas reside. And their basic, even though they're not pure devotees, their basic notion is that they're devotees of the Supreme Personality of God. They have some desire for independence, right? They want to enjoy controlling and having their own domain and this sort of thing. But they understand, for the most part, they have their moments when their vision is clouded. But for the most part, they understand that they're serving at the pleasure of the Supreme Lord, and that their powers are derivative. But still, they have that desire to at least have their own little domain where they execute the Lord's desire, but they do it a little bit independently. They're not doing kind of direct devotional service. They're able to enjoy their position a little bit. And then there's actually this called Bilaswarga, the subterranean heavenly planets, right? And there it's described that through the use of advanced herbology, there are people who understand the use of herbal medicines, that they also are not subject to death by natural causes. Actually, it says that the Lord's Sudarshan Chakra comes and kills them. And down there, their notion is not devotional at all. This is where the Asuras reside. And actually, they're rivals to the Devatas and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they depend a lot more on actual physical technology, yantra, instead of mantra, primarily, machines. And we hear in the Bhagavatam many different places about Maya Danava, who's kind of the supreme technocrat. He's the one who can, he produces the wonderful airplane that Shalva uses to attack Dwarka. This is his notion. But in the higher planetary systems and amongst the higher classes, in the middle planetary system, amongst the brahmanas, the power is mantra. It's a Vedic style of technology. And so when the kshatriyas would go into battle, you know, there's you know, elephants and horses and chariots, and the most powerful warriors were the chariot warriors, the Maharathas, and they would ride into battle in the chariot. And this was, as it turns out, a much more sophisticated weapons platform. We call them weapons platforms these days, right? You can mount weapons on airplanes or tanks or the kind of things. They're weapons platforms. The kshatriya who was riding on the chariot was the ultimate Vedic weapons platform, and that person would use arrows that were infused with mantras. So they would chant the mantras very quickly, and they could produce various effects from the different arrows. Like Prabhupada, in Bhagavad Gita, in the second chapter, when Krishna is describing the nature of the soul, he says, right, it cannot be burned by fire, moistened by water, or withered by the wind. And Prabhupada mentions in the purport how, you know, Krishna was mentioning this because, you know, these are the type of weapons also that he was, you know, trying to get Arjuna to make that connection partially between how the soul was present there and was not going to be affected by this battle, because in the battle he says that the kshatriyas had fire weapons and water weapons and wind weapons. And a Vedic kshatriya could travel out into a modern battlefield, and basically everything on a modern battlefield is a fire weapon, right? The internal combustion engine, the bullets, missiles, everything, it depends upon fire, jet engines. And by releasing a water weapon could neutralize all those things and could turn a modern army into, they're looking around to see where they put their bayonets, which they generally don't use anymore. They would have little sticks with knives on the end of them. That's what they would be reduced to, coming out of their little tanks. And that's what it would be, actually. You know, the battlefield in Vedic times was the infrastructure was less. And there's sustainability, there's beauty. Right, they would go into battle, you know, fully decorated with, you know, golden helmets and earrings and all these things. Even it's funny, even in more recent, within our Kali Yuga history, but you know, a couple of thousand years ago, there's a famous battle when the Romans were trying to expand their empire. They had wars with the city state of Carthage, and there was the famous General Hannibal, who came and invaded Italy and defeated the Romans in a few battles. And there was one particular battle where there was really serious carnage. And they were describing afterwards how the Carthaginians were taking baskets of golden rings and other things from the bodies of the dead soldiers. And these days, right, if you see somebody who's dressed for battle, you know, there's no decorations. You know, in fact, the way the battle is set up now, pretty much, actually, we haven't even seen full-scale battles with modern technology. Even in World War II, it was, you know, horrifying. People felt like they were, you know, just like cockroaches trying to survive. You know. But there, you know, in the Vedic times, you know, they you know, the chariots were beautiful, the warriors were dressed very beautifully, you know, and you know, they're coming out with chariots and horses and elephants, and they go to a specific location. But actually, the technology they have at their disposal is more advanced, because it's based on the Vedic mantras, which, as Prabhupada's mentioned, obviously comes from Krishna. The original Vedic mantra is Om and contains all different potencies. And the different Vedas then called, and the different Vedic mantras call on specific features of that Om. In the Dhanur Veda, the Veda dealing with warfare, the warriors would learn how to chant these various mantras and invoke these special powers that would come in with the weaponry. So you don't have, you know, explosions and jets flying over and some deafening. It's beautiful. They're blowing their conch shells and playing drums and stuff. Like even in more recent times, right, they used to always have the British used to have the little Scottish detachment would always have their bagpipes and their drums with them. Used to have that sort of thing. There used to be, even in more recent times, a certain kind of pageantry that would go along with warfare. Even in the American Civil War, before it was the truth of modern warfare kind of sunk in, during the first battle, the Union troops were marching and people were coming, women were coming and putting roses into the ends of their rifles. Right? It's kind of a throwback to the kind of more attitude that it used to be, because it wasn't so horrific, right? Here the Brahmastra's released and retracted, no lasting effects, right? Here one nuclear bomb goes off and you have radiation, and you have here all over the world today you have unexploded mines in many different places, and you can still sometimes they find unexploded missiles and shells and things, even from World War One, they'll still dig up in Europe and things. There's all kind of residue that goes on. But in the Vedic times, you didn't need a huge infrastructure. You didn't need factories. You weren't producing so many things. So, the Brahmanas, just from the sacred fire, Draupadi and her brother Drishtadyumna came right out of the sacrificial fire. We see other place in the Bhagavatam where so many things are created right from the sacrificial fire. And so things were built to last. Things were built in a very beautiful way. And the prophecy here, he calls it subtle science here, in the purport, that this is a subtle science. So you're using, at the root of the material creation is sound. So that's the first element that comes into place. And so when sound is manipulated, everything else can be, it's at the root. So, you kind of get... below everything else, when you can manipulate sound, you can manipulate all of the grosser manifestations. Right? In computers, you have there's like the assembler language, which is beneath all the other types of languages, and you can manipulate everything if you know how to do that. And so, underneath everything in the universe is sound, and so the Vedic mantras are able to produce effects that are unthinkable. To us, who only in modern world we know really only how to manipulate the very gross things, and so things are kind of clumsy. And as technology progresses, it tries to mimic more and more how a mantra goes. It tries to become less dirty and noisy. Right? If you come up with the first, steam engines and things, how loud and so much smoke and things like that. And now they're trying to find ways to make factories, cleaner and various types of things like that, solar energy and things like this is trying, in the lower planetary systems, their technology is more sophisticated, more resembles, the kind of beauty and efficiency that you have in the Vedas. It's always in the Brahminical culture and in the higher planets, but it's still always. It's always just an imitation. Like Prabhupada even mentioned, he's speaking kind of favorably at that point, but he mentioned that when Bhakti Santa Saraswati sent devotees to England, they stayed there for some time, and they also briefly went to Germany, where they actually made a few devotees. And Prabhupada mentions that one who wasn't impressed with the yogic powers, because he said modern technology had imitated those. You could fly in the sky with the airplanes. And so he was interested in more spiritual dimensions. But really, that's what's happening is the technology is trying to imitate what happens with yogic powers and with the powers that come from the Vedic sacrifice and from the chanting of the Vedic mantras. So here in those days, mantra was more important than yantra, more than machine. It's cleaner. It's more powerful. It's less intrusive. They can just drive out in their chariots with their horses. You don't need, oil refineries, and you don't need, to produce huge quantities of metal. And it's very simple. And they go out and just with their bow and arrows, so they can easily defeat a modern military. A Kshatriya could, with the power of mantra. Prabhupada's mentioning here that he says it is foolish to think that natural laws are ultimately powerful. That's why that people in the modern world will look at a description like that and think that, these people were simply dreaming. That these are against the laws of material nature. And it's actually kind of strange that the only reason they say that actually is because of the there's a certain pride that comes from the modern worldview that we are the most advanced people ever. And people before were just imagining things and superstitious and that sort of thing. Because actually, if you understand modern science, a scientist on one level actually understands that there's a lot of limitations to their knowledge. Right? Because it depends upon what you're able to observe. Every time there's a capacity to observe more, knowledge increases. Right? And although every at least even so-called law of material nature discovered was existing before they discovered it, right? It was there, but they couldn't understand. They didn't have the data. They didn't have the perception to do it. It was always already there. So there's always this understanding, that you can never know what else is out there to be observed. You can try to conclude things from within your purview, right? What your instruments and your senses can do, but from those things you can never be sure what lies beyond. You never can know that. And the other thing that is understood from the Vedas is that the laws of nature change. In on Earth, right? It says that as the yugas progress, from Satya Yuga down to Kali Yuga, each time all the material potencies diminish. Everything material diminishes. It gets weaker and weaker and weaker. People get smaller, people get weaker. Right? And almost every traditional culture you have giants, myths of giants and kind of things, or people more powerful in the past, because they were bigger. Right? When Muchukunda awakens, right, and comes outside from the cave, he says, wow, he sees all the trees are smaller and the people are smaller. And everything is less. When you read the accounts of the battles, right, you see how these, the Kshatriyas are wounded by, two or three arrows, and it just makes them mad. We get stuck in the big toe by an arrow and we're ready to go to the hospital. It's over for us, so everything moves more potent, and if you go to different regions of the universe also, time is different in different regions of the universe, the laws of nature are different, the types of bodies are different in the higher planetary systems, so there's so much that we can't understand simply by studying even very minutely things close to us in this time and place. And what to speak of understanding the connection with the higher powers that come through the Vedas. So here we're influenced now in these ages more by kind of the lower planetary systems. Right? When Krishna was present, there was an attempt being made actually by the, because there's always that cosmic war between the asuras and the suras, the devatas and the demigods and the demons. And so during Krishna's time, there was an attempt to infiltrate the earth. When it says in Krishna book that that the world had been overburdened by the unnecessary defense forces of many kings who were actually demons, it didn't just mean that they were regular kings who kind of were taking on some atheistic tendencies. They actually, according to the Mahabharata and stuff, were actually the asuras who had come and taken birth there. There's a I think it's in the Mahabharata, an episode where actually some of those folks come and they pull Duryodhana aside and say, we placed you here, and you're not living up to expectations. You got to get rid of these Pandavas. They actually were trying to take over in an indirect way, And that's one of the reasons why Krishna was killing so many of them. Mm-hmm. That they actually were coming. So these days we're dealing more with yantra, machines, and we take that as advancement. And the consequences are, the biggest consequences is that we're unaware of the connection with Krishna. This is the biggest beauty of the Vedas. There are many side benefits as well. So that you get a sustainable society, you get a beautiful society, you get a stable society. When you follow the Vedic culture, things are prosperous. Prabhupada mentions, I think Prabhupada mentioned someplace, right, that Hawaii has the wonderful climate because there are many, many, many sacrifices performed there, and so there's still, because it says, when Yudhisthira was ruling the planet, that no place was too hot or too cold. The whole earth was a nice climate. And it's only because of impious activities. We're getting snow outside today, so this is the impious activities, are coming in us. It's not just the northern latitude. It's impious activities, But the real benefit of the Vedas is that one is, well, at least has, one is almost forced, but at least one has a very strong push to understand the presence of God there, right? Who are the Vedas coming from, right? They're coming from the Lord, and the Om, which is the root of the bija of all the Vedas, is Krishna says, it's I'm the Om. It's ultimately a spiritual vibration. So the modern scientific advancement tends to be dependent upon yantras, and it becomes forgetful. It begins to think that I'm discovering laws of nature which are somehow fixed and that I can manipulate. Right? People are thinking that that only now is intelligence being used on the planet. Right? That previously that things just developed in kind of an organic way, but there wasn't a plan. There wasn't a structure. We understand that everything was Lord Brahma. He also used the Vedas as a template for creating the universes, and the universes have a certain structure. Each Upanishad says right away, there's a plan there. There's a place for everything. Right? We as human beings have the ability to choose to take up our rightful place or to try to defy that. But there's a structure and an organization, and anyone with a brain can look around and see that, how things are interrelated, interdependent, and why is it that the things that grow you can eat? It wouldn't have to be that way. But in modern times it's thought, these things happen through evolution, these kind of things, and so this. But there was no real plan behind it, and now that we have intelligence, we can impose our plan on the world. And of course, sometimes it's ecological disaster and political and cultural disaster happens because our knowledge isn't very good. But in the Vedic times, they recognized, how there was an order that was established by God. And there was higher technology that also helped them to remember their connection with Krishna. Much better state of circumstances. So when we see, when we see Arjuna there on his chariot, we shouldn't think of ancient Egypt or ancient Rome or in Kali Yuga, where they're just fighting with swords and spears and arrows. This is a much more sophisticated enterprise. As we see from this incident, they had much more sophisticated weapons than we do today, a much more sophisticated technology than we do today, and a godly one. So we've taken up, because of the influence of Kali, we've generally taken up the atheistic atheistic technology has now become our measure of advancement. We're trying to make our little imitation, kingdom of God, not our own God projects. And what we're trying to understand, from the Srimad Bhagavatam is, not only there's a higher technology, but then there's God behind it. So we're at 1:15 my time, I guess about 8:15 yours in Hawaii, and so it's time for me to step aside and let some of the rest of you participate.
I'd like to have a wonderful class as always. You never let us down. Prabhuji, I wanted to ask a question. I realize sometimes I ask a question, I sort of have some understanding of the answer, but I want to deepen that understanding. I've got one I have very little understanding. And Mahaprabhu came, you were speaking a lot about the different planetary systems and self-realization and so on. So I was wondering that Lord Chaitanya came 500 years ago here to this planet and that to establish the Yuga Dharma. How is that spreading beyond our planet? I mean, is it spreading also? Is it destined for heavenly planets as well as hellish planets, the Sankirtan Jagya?
I mean, I know for one thing, it's mentioned, right, that the Devatas looked down and wished to take birth on Earth in the age of Kali when Lord Chaitanya's movement is present, because they are able to see the speed at which spiritual advancement is taking place, right? Because I mean, they're highly qualified entities, but and they live a very long time. But generally, they're mixed devotees for the most part. Our Brahma happens to be a pure devotee now, but most of them are mixed devotees, and they see these completely lowborn creatures within from their point of view an insanely short period of time, becoming devotees. And of course the power of the mantra, it goes through all the ether. So I don't really know specifically about, how it travels to other planets, and because there's of course entities that go there, Narad Muni travels to all many different planets, and there's still, very powerful beings. So I haven't heard anything. That's exactly how it's going to go to the lower planetary systems or how it spreads everywhere. But you know that there's a lot of contact. The persons in the lower planetary systems and persons in the higher planetary systems have a lot more mobility than we do. The sages on the higher planetary systems and the devatas and even those persons in the lower planetary systems have contact. They can travel much more easily. Shalva's airplane and things, they can go. And so, and they're monitoring this place. So so even if I'm not sure if we're going to have Hare Krishnas traveling to other places, but certainly other persons are going to come here. And as the movement increases and expands, they're going to have contact. Like Lord Chaitanya, when he was traveling through, taking his tour of India, South India, it says right there, people who saw him got Krishna prema. And like little typhoid Marys, they would go back to their villages, and whoever saw them got Krishna prema. So right now, we're kind of in the beginning stages of Lord Chaitanya's movement spreading and developing. And so as more and more, as it grows more and more, and as people become more and more purified. It's hard to understand how far reaching the effects can be, and I don't have any solid information. I'm presuming it's going to go elsewhere because people are coming here and are going to see it, and they're going to some of them are going to be able to are going to become devotees because of it.
Do you think Lord Chaitanya, being Patita Pavana, savior of the most fallen, you'd think that it would there's some plan for it to also spread, especially to the hellish planets? But I've never read anything or heard anything. That's why I'm asking the question. Maybe.
Can I say a little remark on that? On Yadubar's movie, Prabhupada, the devotees, when they speak about memories from with Prabhupada, one devotee from France was telling story that he asked directly Prabhupada where he's going to be after death, next life. And Prabhupada told him, he said, you're going to be preaching on lower planetary system. So
looks like a plan. is in place, right? It looks like your intuition was correct. More comments? More questions?
I have some questions. These are the type, because I'm going to ask is the time it's what I would expect. If Prabhupada heard it, he would just not answer it. But I'm going to ask it anyway. You know, we're looking at this, these last few verses, like starting from verse 22, and Arjuna is offering prayers to Krishna because he sees the glaring effulgence. And he's frightened. He thinks this would endanger his own life. So he offers prayers to Krishna. Krishna responds. Arjuna circumambulates the Lord. He takes Achman. He chants mantras. And then he counteracts the weapon of Ashwatthama. Now, in modern warfare, you know, if it takes a bit, less than a second, you know, to have a bullet go towards you, or you know, some ordnance explode, or some, you know, like if it's an atomic explosion, it's in a fraction of a second. So, I know this is kind of a superficial question, but you think that there's probably 5 or 10 minutes that have passed at least. So how did Arjuna have so much time to do it?
I don't know. I guess it sounds like it's kind of a, you know, slow developing weapon, you know, because I mean, I guess it's so powerful, right? That it's covering the whole universe. So where are you going to hide, right? What's if it's going to work, if you don't have a way to counteract it, you know, like it can take its time. Doesn't have to hurry up, because where are you going to run?
Okay, here's another question for you. You know, just like if the Earth is just slightly tilted back towards the sun, it becomes very hot. And then when it tilts the other way, it gets really cold. So, or even, you know, you go towards the fire and you get really close to it. You can burn yourself, but you get farther away, you can't even feel it. So similarly, this weapon, you would think that if you can feel it all over the universe, in the upper, middle, and lower planetary systems, if it's originating on Earth, then that would certainly be the hot spot. I know these are superficial questions, but just finding them out.
I'm not sure if it's it would seem that because it's a subtle weapon, a mantra weapon, that it wouldn't necessarily have to be like a central source where all the heat's coming from, like a single explosion. It seems like maybe it's spreading subtly to different areas and, you know, producing heat there. That I'm not sure. I'm not sure about the details of how the Brahmastra works. So I'm thinking that it doesn't have to be a central explosion that radiates, but rather the mantra produces that effect locally as it travels through the ether.
Okay. Again, I'm sure that if Prabhupada heard questions like this, he just wouldn't even answer them. But I thought I'd throw it out.
This is Dasarath. I have there's mental speculation and there's philosophical speculation. At best, this seems to be an area of philosophical speculation, since none of us probably have any realization of it. It could only refer to what Prabhupada said. And, doesn't seem like people have too much of an answer to that. But it's an interesting pattern of thinking to try to figure out all the specifics of the energies.
That's a fact. We're in a little bit in the dark here.
I think this is Gandhari here. I think it... answers would obviously be in the Dhanurveda. So people who are studying that, in fact, the person who is writing something here, his name is Radharaman Prabhu, is translating something on the Viva from Jiva Goswami, I think. Anyway, so he was mentioning that it is a duty of every Brahmana to recite Dharnurveda to his pregnant wife for the benefit of the child. So even though, of course, I mean, even though he's a Brahmin, so the Brahmin knows the art of the Kshatriyas, which are obviously in the Vedas. So I'm sure the questions that you're asking would be there and all the weapons would be described in there. So it won't be long before all this information is out, you know. So personally, I had a question about, you know, these 10,000 years of Lord Chaitanya, but I was wondering if anybody has worked it out in comparison to the higher planetary system. What would be 10,000 years in comparison to the higher planetary system? It might be very insignificant. So that would be quite...
10,000 days, huh? Because I think a 24-hour period in the heavenly planets is a year here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, as far as I understand it, the 10,000-year period here on Earth is earthly years.
Yes, earthly years.
Yeah. So in the heavenly planets, 24 hours is a year. So for them, it's 10,000 days.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking sometimes when Prabhupada, people would ask Prabhupada these complicated questions, Prabhupada would just say, just try to understand you're not your body.
Yeah, a lot of times detailed information about things isn't so important. We need to know how to chant Hare Krishna with attention, that's the main thing. Do we really need to know this to go back to Godhead?
No, I mean everything we need to know is there in the Bhagavad Gita and what's it, the first three volumes of the Bhagavatam. It's the first three volumes or first three cantos? What was it that Prabhupada said?
Yeah, he had the first canto, the first three volumes. That's what he had with him.
He
specifically put, you know, he tried to put everything into that. He said because he wasn't sure about whether he'd be able to produce the rest of them. You know?
And he did say that's all we need. You know, ultimately, that's all we need. It's nice to expand the literatures, of course, but everything we need to know is right there.
Yeah, intellectual knowledge isn't really going to help us that much. You know?
But thank you for indulging me.
There's a story from Guru Kripa. He says that he was in South India, I think Madras, and he was asking Prabhupada about the grass, how it comes through a sidewalk. And, you know, some really just to ask him something, and Prabhupada gave him this look of disgust, like Ramananda said, without even answering. And he knew he had to choose better the type of questions he asked Prabhupada, especially Prabhupada. We're just trying to keep the topic going here of the weaponry.
You know, one time in Hawaii, I believe it was, I heard this on a tape. There was the prophet asked any questions, and one of the devotees asked, so in what place in the heart is the spirit soul, and what location? And prophet said, well, are you a doctor? What is it? thank you for indulging me.
The soul's in the left ventricle because that's the largest one.
Is that right? Okay.
Mary Harry's background.
Well, it seems that we kind of ran out of momentum. And I appreciate all of your association. Okay.
I was just going to say, where's Madame Mohan? He always has a good question or a comment.
If the Paramatma is in the heart, when somebody gets a heart transplant, what happens? How do that work?
My understanding is the soul is very subtle, and so I think it's like more in the heart chakras, what I understand. But also Prabhupada mentions that it energizes the blood. You know, so I don't know what I mean, I guess when there's a heart transplant, the soul has supposedly left the one body. And I'm not sure how it all works. The soul is very subtle. I don't know how that...
Actually, when they do the heart transplant, the heart is still alive, although it's out of the body. And when they put it on the body, they don't need to like put electricity or anything. It just like starts.
Actually, Prabhupada was asked that question directly. He gave a direct answer.
Oh, great. Let's hear it.
he said, you know, everything's so simple for the simple and a lot of simple answers. But he said, it's just like if you're sitting in one chair and you get up and sit in another chair. That's it. You take that part out. You're there and you put in another one. So, but you can elaborate. You could try to speculate after that. Well, does it go out with the heart and then jump back in the body? But he just said like that. It's just like changing chairs, changing seats.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was listening. I was thinking, I heard this one conversation recently from a memories tape, and Balavanta was talking with Prabhupada, and Prabhupada told him that Krishna consciousness isn't a religion. It's a science of realization. So I've kind of noticed that what's required for you to go to the next stage of your Krishna consciousness, your interaction with Prabhupada, your surrender, that's what's the crucial points. The rest of it is... It may be useful, but it has to fall under a particular category of how you're going to apply it in your surrender. So just like it says, one should inquire from a spiritual master, what's it, 434, and ask relevant questions. So sometimes he did make that point because we should be thinking, how can I improve my Krishna consciousness? What will help me? And the intelligence is directed according to that. But that's close as I can get to this type of conversation. I'm sorry.
That's a good point.
That was very well said. That was very well said, actually. Yeah, that was perfect. what really helps us in our surrender? Yeah.
Well said, Madan.
Just wanted to add other side of it is that people, you know, who want to be have their intellect stimulated. Or they have all these questions. It is natural because they may have reached that stage where they may want to go further and learn, you know. So that is there also. I mean, they might have been gnanis in previous life. So the scriptures are there as well.
Yeah. That's also a good point because I mean that's you know we have so many scriptures and so many shastras and stuff and you know. Different people have different, you know, levels of have to purify their minds. You know, people who are, you know, really on the mental platform, who are, you know, intellectual people, and you know, they have to have some way to purify their minds. So that's why we have so many you know volumes of scripture and things like that. But even for them, it's good for them to keep that in mind that really the purpose of purifying their minds and is to get them to surrender and to go forward and you know the real basic thing is you know we have to chant Hare Krishna with attention and try to give up offenses and that's what's and everything will be understood after that. You don't have to worry so much. We can try to accumulate so many volumes of knowledge and memorize so many things and you know I said depending on our mental situation that may be the best way to purify that, you know. But really we need to try to focus on the essence as much as possible.
I remember when we were reading the second canto, second chapter, the Lord and the second chapter. Anyway, that went. I think it's Lord in the Heart, and it talks about these yogis and these other planetary systems. I remember discussing how are we going to go by those places without stopping off to check it out. You know, curiosity. Could get us into another situation because if you are interested, then Krishna, he fulfills your desire. You'll get that information, but what are you going to do with it? You know. So I remember thinking about going by these higher planetary systems and taking a second look. And oh, you would like to stop there and check it out? It could be a detour on your expressway.
That described in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, where it says those persons on the way to liberation, you know, that they not only in the higher planetary systems, but as they pass through the coverings of the universe, each covering of the universe is like so many times more heavenly than the previous one, higher than, no, more heavenly than Brahma's planet, and then the next one so many more times heavenly. And every time there's an invitation there. There's some devi, some goddesses. There's Mother Bhumi during in the earth layer, and says, "Here, come, and you know, we're worshiping the Lord here. You come and stay." And so, yeah, those things are there. And so, you know, but that's why we, you know, by the grace of the Lord, you know, we can have only one goal in mind, you know. So I said, for purposes of satisfying our restless minds, you know, we can try to understand certain things, but if we get diverted from the real purpose, and at the application, I think also Mother Mohan Prabhu, we mentioned how we apply it. You know, we can have all the information, but if we don't apply it, it's simply theoretical. So really, we're trying to become purified, and we're trying to deepen our attachment for Krishna, so that there's no other attachment. And you know, that's you know, if we lose that in the pursuit of information, then it's our great misfortune.
Gary Govardhan Prabhu, I have one last question. It's a more serious question. You know, we see that Droni, Ashwatthama, of course, he wanted revenge because of how Duryodhana was dying, how he was defeated. So he was on his way to the camp, and he had every intention of going into the camp at night and killing what he thought it was the Pandavas and everyone else. But then Lord Shiva met him in a particular form, and Lord Shiva informed him that the time for all these soldiers has expired, even though I protected them up to this point. Now I am empowering you. And he even gave him a weapon, a special sword, I think, to go and kill everybody. So still, Droni had to suffer the reaction of his activities. It was his desire. He was empowered by Lord Shiva to carry out Lord Shiva's function of annihilating these Kshatriyas that were in the camp. But still, Ashwatthama had to suffer. So what I was thinking is that in a similar way, if we have a strong desire to do something, then Krishna may fulfill our desire, and it'll appear that it'll just fall into our hands. So we can think that, oh, well, this is Krishna's arrangement. But still, it doesn't mean that we don't have to suffer the consequences.
If we're attached to the fruits of the fruits of our activities, then those things come upon us, right? So even if we're, whether we're doing something pious or impious, if we're attached to the fruits, like, you know, Krishna mentions to Arjuna that he's supposed to fight without notion of victory, defeat, loss, or gain. You know, that the important, so much is important, is not only what you do, but how you do it. And so by you know, Arjuna even did things during the battle that were, he killed Karna when Karna was, you know, his chariot was immobilized, you know, or Yudhisthira did something told the lie that Ashwatthama, whispering the elephant, was dead. In order to destroy to kill Dronacharya, but you know, if you do directly what's instructed by Krishna, whatever it is, then of course Krishna is the highest notion of good and evil, right? And you do it without self interest, then you know it's simple devotion. But even if you do something that's allowed by the Vedas or something that's permissible, but you're attached to the results, those results are going to stay with you.
There's a subtle point to that, too, that even if Krishna tells you directly to do something, he may be testing you. That'll be coming up in text 39 of this chapter, where Krishna tells Arjuna, kill Ashwatthama, and Arjuna doesn't do it. That's carried on later in this story, so I've been waiting for when I can get an opportunity to ask the questions on that one, because, in fact, I've been asking different people about that question. Now, he gets rewarded by Krishna, were not listening to him, and the purport Prabhupada says that he was testing him. But when Yudhisthira, he hesitated, he got, that was a whole big thing about that, his chariot hit the ground and stuff. So even when Krishna directly tells you something, he's still checking that out. And I got some fairly nice answers on that, asking a lot of different people what the, why Krishna or you, Arjun, he got said that he passed the test, or Yudhisthira didn't listen. He didn't, but here Arjun didn't listen to Krishna directly telling him, kill him. It's in the text itself, and he didn't listen. So sometimes there's something even subtler than that. Because what does Krishna like even more than you listening to him? Who does he like you to listen to the most?
Madan, one thought just came to my mind that kind of protects us from that, and that is we really don't listen to Krishna directly. Anyway, we hear from our spiritual master. And I don't think there's any case where Prabhupada would ever tell us to do something that he didn't want us to do. Of course, there is the example of Bali Maharaj, who disobeyed the order of his spiritual master when it was contrary to scripture, when he told him, you know, not to give the three steps of land to Vaman. But anyway, that just thought crossed my mind, is that we hear direct, we hear from Prabhupada, and when, even when we read Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, it's always purported by the acharyas. So we listen to the acharyas, not Krishna directly. And I don't think we have to worry about Prabhupada ever telling us to do something and us not doing it.
No, that's a general principle, but there will always be some subtle points. You know, if you ever notice the intrigue, that something's just not exactly clear. And that's, I've noticed that intrigue is done very fascinatingly to pull out what's in your heart. You know, you can't say, well, this person says this, this one says that. There's different things. So ultimately, Krishna will get you to reveal what's exactly in your heart. And that's quite fascinating when it becomes that intense.
So, Madan, what were the answers? What were the sort of sum up for us? What were the answers you heard to the question?
Well, there's a nice devotee, Krishna Kripa. He writes answers for, he's a brahmachari, he travels around. He gave the answer that I like the best. He said that Krishna's, he likes you to listen to the devotees even more than him. To please the devotees. He likes to please the devotees. So he ended up doing everything that pleased both his wife, because he killed him, he didn't kill him. So he satisfied everybody, which was quite fascinating use of his expertise. But that was the answer. The other one said that when Yudhisthira didn't do it, it was a type of pride because he was always an honest person. So he was he didn't want to go against religious principles, which we know Arjuna had some trouble with that in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, following religious principles. And Arjuna, he also was doing it more on a religious principle, you know, that he didn't do that because Aswatthama was the son of a Brahmin, it was son of his teacher, he was doing all those things. But I didn't accept that. I didn't think that answer was as good as the one that Krishna Kripa gave me with you to please you.
But that was an Arjuna's argument. That was Draupadi's argument about not wanting to kill. He was angry. He had, his eyes were red like copper balls. Yeah. So Arjuna was ready to do that also. I mean, he was angry, of course. But there is a similar, I cannot answer on that, but there is a similar statement by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita where he says that this science should not be or told to the you know, unqualified or those who are not strict in their vows. But you know, Srila Prabhupada's answers to that is that you know, devotees disobey Krishna's instruction in this one because they are even kinder than Krishna. So I'm just bringing the similarity of the question, you know, in that concern.
Nice point.
Do you understand? Yeah? Do you get it?
Yeah, that's nice. Okay. Also, like, who can preach the glories of the holy name to the faithless? When Prabhupada came, that's all there was. So I thought it was very ingenuous how he gave everybody faith first. Sukriti, I call it Kripa Sukriti. He gave everybody the good fortune to have the faith so he could tell us. Anyway, those are subtle points, I guess. Thank you.
Getting a little late, I'd like to hear Giri Govardhan. What would you say?
I think someone said very nicely, you know, that I also like that answer that he was listening to his devotees, because Krishna has a relationship. It's relationship, you know, and so his that's his prime quality, right? Is that he's bhaktavatsala. That he has a relationship with his devotees, and so he was he was also having fun with Arjuna to see him be put in a difficult position. You know, he likes that. He enjoys that. And so finally, he tells him. Krishna right tells him at that point. He has to satisfy them both. You know? I'm saying kill him, and she's saying this. You have to do that. He gives him a little hint. I think finally, he says, you know, it's all to resolve it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I like that. I like that answer that he was respecting his devotees.
Okay, Prabhus, I have to interrupt. It's we're about 15 minutes over. Thank you very much, Giri Govardhan Prabhu, as always, for a very nice class.
I thank all of you.
Very, wonderful class, Prabhuji. Thank you so much.
You.
I'll be waiting another 14 days for you to be back.
That's true, Prabhu. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow we're lined up with Hanuman Prasheka Swami. I hope that will happen, but if not, we'll make other arrangements. Thank you very much, Prabhu, for listening.
Thank you, Ramananaji.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.